Forgive me. I'm sorry. How many times do you use those words every day? Those who live within the British Isles are sometimes viewed by other nationalities as an apologetic people. Saying sorry, seeking the forgiveness of others, is often used as a conversation filler, with no reason for an apology. Apologies aren't just for the genuine mistakes we make, like using the wrong title for the assistant organist on the order of the service. Sorry, Willie. But we find ourselves apologising for the behaviour of others and events beyond our control. In the Debrett's Guide to British Etiquette and Behaviour, its entry on apologising reads, "For many British people, apologising is a default reaction to life's little irritants. If someone barges into you, treads on your toes, or spills your drink, it is considered quite normal for the victim to mutter sorry. This is clearly illogical, but for many British people, it is an ingrained response. The urge to apologise for other people's actions is clearly misplaced. Constant, needless apologising devalues the currency and will lessen the impact of a genuine, heartfelt mea culpa." Of course, the seeking and giving of forgiveness comes from a much deeper place than the apology for casual mistakes and life's irritants. News stories every week speak of situations where we wonder at the capacity of others to offer forgiveness at what seem like the most horrendous of situations. And perhaps we are so aware of our own feelings and failings that we have felt overwhelmed by the forgiveness that has been offered to us by others and by God. In recent weeks, we've heard the parents of James Foley, the American journalist, speak of the forgiveness they hope they will one day be able to offer following their son's beheading. Their story is not unusual, for many will remember others, like Gordon Wilson, who became a peace campaigner following the death of his daughter, or Jim Swire, who lost his daughter in the Lockerbie bombing. A charity called the Forgiveness Project uses their website to tell the stories of many who have found ways to forgive those who have harmed them. The stories come from across the world and are wide-ranging in the pains inflicted on others, from those trapped and tortured in concentration camps, to physical and sexual abuse, to racist attacks and political cruelty. The aim of the charity is to provide the tools that enable conflict resolution and promote behavioural change while working with offenders and victims of crime. Forgiveness is so much part of our Christian terminology that perhaps we forget about the real impact it can have within our own lives and the life of the community of which we are part. We forget that it's not just about saying sorry or being sorry, but instead can lead to transformed ways of living. What's good about our readings this morning is that we discover that it's not just us who fail to understand what it means to live as forgiven people, or to live as those willing to forgive. Instead, being reluctant to receive forgiveness, play out in what we have heard. In Genesis, we find Joseph's brothers unsure whether Joseph has really forgiven them, but they may also be wondering if they've really forgiven him. While Peter questions Jesus about how many times someone can be forgiven. If we don't know the story of Joseph and his rise to a political force in Egypt from Sunday school and children's Bibles, then perhaps we're familiar with it in its technicolored musical. We know of Joseph's boasting, his father Jacob's spoiling of him, his brother's hatred of him, and the story that leads to their final reconciliation. So it's interesting to discover that the story isn't quite ended with that reconciliation and forgiveness. With the death of their father, Joseph's brothers doubt the forgiveness that Joseph had already offered them. The passage we read marks the end of a lengthy passage recounting the dying Jacob's predicting of his sons' futures and the blessing of Joseph's sons. With his death, Jacob's sons realise that he can no longer protect them. And so this next episode is a reminder of the brothers of old. We find that they doubt forgiveness. They cannot believe that Joseph has truly forgiven them for the behaviour that took him to Egypt. We don't know if they put words into their father's mouth, or if they're words that Jacob genuinely said. However, what we discover in allowing them to come as Jacob's voice is that the brothers want Joseph to see them through their father's eyes. And we gain insight into their fear rather than their sorrow. It's Joseph who sums up the theme of the passage in his assurance of his forgiveness and his recognition that the life he has led lay in God's hands. In forgiveness, we live in the knowledge that our lives lie with God. Matthew's gospel makes it clear that forgiveness is not an option. In what we heard, we have a discussion that leads to a parable, and it's perhaps worth quickly looking at those two sections separately. Peter's asking Jesus about the limits of forgiveness. He's looking for a legal response, but instead he gets a response that invites him to a place where counting is not important. Love cannot be counted. Love cannot be quantified. Instead, love in the form of forgiveness is extravagant and precious. It's of course worth knowing that the theologian and preacher William Barclay wrote in his commentary on this passage that we can't be certain that these are the precise words of Jesus. Instead, they could be words using those that weren't Jesus's, that take similar themes and put them together, accentuating a response to an issue that is maybe lying within the Christian community that's forming around Matthew's gospel. In the second part of what we heard, we move to Jesus's story of the unmerciful servant. It's important to remember that parables often use hyperbole to express the depth of God's love for humanity. Perhaps to gain an understanding of the excess of God's love and the challenge to live as those who forgive, there's little purpose in knowing that a talent was 130 pounds of silver. That's equivalent to 15 years of a labourer's wage. And so the debt which the servant owes is equivalent to 150,000 years of labour, something that can never be paid back. The point is made again that forgiveness is generous and without contractual agreement. It is a gift freely given by God, offered to us so that we may also offer the gift to others. Like Peter, we are to understand that forgiveness is relational, reciprocal, and reliant. It has to be part of sharing life with other people. It shapes the communities we are part of and the people we are. Life should be lived in the knowledge that forgiveness is something we will seek time and time again, not just from family, friends, and neighbours, but as we gather Sunday by Sunday, as we're embraced in the arms of God, acknowledging our wonder of him. In faith, we discover that we too must be willing to forgive. and do so in the knowledge that in offering forgiveness, we must be willing to wipe the slate clean for another and rebuild our relationship with them. But that's the hard part of forgiveness. Because at times we will feel that there are wrongs that we just can't forgive. In his commentary on the text, Eric Barreto writes, "Forgiveness does not mean the embrace of violence against it. It doesn't mean giving free rein to those who could do us harm. It doesn't mean not being ready to acquiesce to those who are stronger than us. The context of the teachings is key. Forgiveness is a gift of grace, a reflection of God's love, not the curse of abuse or a reflection of our worst tendencies as humans." When we think of forgiveness and how it is given or received, we know that it can cost to forgive. How we feel as those who've been relatively unaffected by an event, by a tragedy, by a world event, compared to those whose lives are completely torn apart, or whose lives continue to be affected. Those feelings will be dramatically different than those living in the midst of it. It is relatively easy to forgive something which was a mere inconvenience to our lives in comparison to it turning and tearing yourself apart or your family apart. Perhaps Archbishop Desmond Tutu offers us some insight when he says, "Forgiveness doesn't mean condoning what has been. It means taking what has happened seriously and not minimising it, drawing out the sting in the memory that threatens to poison our existence. It involves trying to understand the perpetrators and so have empathy to try to stand in their shoes and appreciate the sort of pressures and influences that might have conditioned them." Unlike some communities across Scotland and even elsewhere in the table, we as a congregation, as a church, have moved from our sense of being unworthy to approach the Lord's table. Here in Dunfermline Abbey, I hope that those who come to share in communion do so because that they are assured that they are loved and forgiven by God unconditionally. Our table is open to members, but it's also open to all those who know and love the Lord, no matter what they have done. Our response to that unconditional love and forgiveness is to receive the grace of the Lord and then to live in that grace. There's an invitation placed within that grace, that we too will find ways in which to live lives willing to offer forgiveness. Perhaps we found ourselves already tested, struggling to let go of a past hurt or wrong. And so we long for the grace of God, to let go of the hope that the past can be changed. Because we know it can't. Maybe as we struggle with the decisions we will make this week, we will need to relearn forgiveness. To forgive the heated words and exchanges of politicians and campaigners, even our own family and friends, and instead build a community inspired by God's love, his reconciliation, and perhaps most importantly, his forgiveness. What we learn of forgiveness, though, is that just as we cannot limit how many times we must offer it, we also never know when it will be asked of us. Instead, in the words of Martin Luther King Jr., forgiveness is not an occasional act, it is a constant attitude. And so a story to finish. A Cherokee elder was teaching his grandchildren about life. He said to them, "A fight is going on inside me. It's a terrible fight, and it's between two wolves. One wolf represents fear, anger, envy, sorrow, regret, greed, arrogance, self-pity, guilt, resentment, inferiority, jealousy, and lies. The other wolf stands for peace, joy, love, hope, sharing, serenity, humility, kindness, benevolence, friendship, empathy, generosity, truth, and compassion. The same fight is going on inside of you, and every other person too. The children thought about it for a minute, and then one child asked his grandfather, "Which wolf will win?" The wise one replied, "The one I feed." Amen.